this week, Cinema International is showing District 9. This is a movie that was made in 2009 in South Africa. It was directed by and written by a man named Neil Blomkamp and Terry Tatchell, who's his collaborator. It was actually produced by Peter Jackson. I think that's why it was somewhat well-known in 2009. So Blomkamp, he is a South African director. He was born there. He's a little younger than me. He was born in the late 70s. He moved to Vancouver, Canada when he was 18. But this movie very much has several layers of meaning that are drawn from his South African experience. So right off the bat, let's talk a little bit about the title. That's probably the most obvious reference to South Africa. So District 9, this is supposed to be an analog to District 6. This was a neighborhood in Cape Town. I lived there for most of 2005. I was there with students. So District 6 is now an abandoned field, though finally construction has started there. So when I was there in 2005, it was deserted. It had been established in the 1860s, around 1867, 68, and it was sort of overlooking the docks. It was an incredibly cosmopolitan neighborhood. The majority of people living there were so-called Cape Colored. These were people of mixed descent, but there were a fair amount of Xhosa, Jewish immigrants. It had synagogues across from churches, across from mosques. It was an incredibly cosmopolitan, lively place where people would go to listen to jazz music and sort of transgress the norms of segregation. Segregation was already well in place in the 19th and early 20th centuries in South Africa, much like the American South or a place like Algeria. In any case, this vibrant, multicultural, multiracial neighborhood was ultimately deemed a security risk, and the entire region, because of its proximity to downtown, was named an all-white area, is how they phrase this. This is part of the Group Areas Act of 1950. This happens in 66. It's not until 68 they began literally bulldozing District 6 and forcing the people out about 25 kilometers to the Cape Flats. These are like salt flats, and that already gives you some sense of what they were like. It was a desolate place. People still from there live in that area and commute an incredibly long distance to work. It was a great hardship. And a lot of what you see in this movie in terms of the legalese of the notices put on their doors and all the sort of whole sort of veneer of legality is very much how apartheid worked. And again, we can talk more in a moment about sort of how that had been constructed. So District 9, you know, in this case, instead of black or so-called colored South Africans, these are prawns. These are aliens that come. This is a parallel reality where these aliens show up in 1982 and end up in these horrible sort of camps that are actually run by the time the movie happens by a private corporation. So there are also ways in which this movie doesn't just look back to apartheid, but looks forward to the sort of neoliberal corporate South Africa. They're living in these conditions. This thing, MNU, Multinational United, is quote unquote taking care of them, has this government contract, and ultimately decides to move them all out to what they claim are better accommodations that clearly are not. They're essentially moving them out to the salt flats, so to speak, to clear the area. And basically they're going to put them in camps, in concentration camps as opposed to an informal settlement. And as I said, this is exactly what it was like. District 6, you were given very little notice. You were told, you need to get out of here now. This is an all-whites area. The place you're moving to is going to be fantastic, which was, of course, a lie, and everybody knew it. You know, the movie then goes through, I mean, essentially, Vic, who's the main character, accidentally, I don't want to give away too much, for various reasons, comes to understand the prawn problem much more intimately and develops a lot of sympathy with them. Things get quite complicated, but the picture you get is not only a really searing indictment of apartheid, you know, this systematic segregation, the system that was set up in 1948, but also of South Africa's current reality. So whether it's the fact that it's sort of a multinational corporation that is doing all this, or the xenophobia that the prawns are facing, this is an analog not just for what was happening in the 60s or 70s. This is supposed to represent particularly Zimbabwean immigrants, but also I would say Congolese and Nigerians. And you see a little of that because there was a Nigerian gang in the movie. So since 1994, where you have this flip and apartheid is deconstructed, at least in the political realm, large numbers of immigrants have moved from other parts of Africa. South Africa by itself is a fifth the so-called GNP of the entire continent. And Gauteng, the area around Joburg, is half of that. So enormous wealth to be had, maybe. At one point, I think the number was as many as 1 million Zimbabweans had crossed because Limpopo, due to things like climate change, has dried up and part of the year is essentially passable on foot. And this was going on during filming. They filmed this in Soweto and Joburg, so in Gauteng in northeastern South Africa. While this was going on, there was anti-Zimbabwean rioting going on, and a really ugly discourse about essentially labeling Zimbabweans and Congolese and Nigerians all sort of criminals and destabilizing. So Brunkamp was not only critiquing the apartheid era, but also the current reality of racism against later African immigrants. And that doesn't scan for Americans because, but they're all African, but yeah.
Let's talk about apartheid.
Yeah, please.
It's not something that we can really do justice to in just a few moments, but I think even a brief overview is going to be beneficial to those, just in general, to understand it, and also before going to see District 9.
Yeah, I know that's not a background we really have. When I was a little kid, it was still in the news a lot. Mm-hmm. So Free Nelson Mandela, and it was very sort of present. But essentially, since 1994, it kind of dropped out of the news. South Africa was settled back in the 17th century by the Dutch. Mm-hmm. And eventually you have English settlers come in. And so you have this hybrid colonial society that evolves that did have slavery, that had both an English and a Dutch-speaking white community that didn't get along particularly well. You had this other category of people that were essentially the result of mixed unions between people. And so by the sort of 19th and early 20th centuries, you had a society that was incredibly multicultural and multi-ethnic, but had only just gotten out of slavery. So slavery ends there roughly the same time as here, sort of an arc from the early 19th century into the 1830s. So it was a post-slavery society, but it had a system of segregation in some ways not unlike that in other post-slavery societies. So whether it's certain parts of the Caribbean or the American South, you know, think North Carolina or Louisiana or Algeria, French colonial Algeria, this was not uncommon. Indeed, I would argue that just about every colony in Africa had, particularly in urban areas, some degree of segregation. So in that respect, South Africa wasn't necessarily that unique or particular until the mid-20th century. And that's where they really, in many ways, part company both with other societies that have segregation, but also with other colonial societies, because they hit this fork in the road during the Second World War where they have to decide, people are pouring into the cities to produce munitions, and they have to decide, are we going to allow segregation, and that's what it was called at the time, to crumble, or are we going to double down and reimpose some new sort of system? And in most of the world, in the 40s and 50s, of course, this is the era of civil rights. This is the era of decolonization. Most other areas, I don't want to, you know, overly beautify the situation. It was complicated and often messy, but ultimately, you know, you need only look at our own campus with the plaque in terms of segregation by the 50s is happening. South Africa goes the opposite direction, largely because of a single election. So in 1948, the National Party, who was essentially an Afrikaner, these were the Dutch speakers, Afrikaner nationalist upliftment party, essentially. It was almost like an affirmative action party for Afrikaners, vis-a-vis not only blacks, but also English-speaking South Africans. They won by a razor-thin margin, essentially. They beat the Unionists, who were the traditional British Empire-oriented segregationist party. They beat them. And, you know, one of the things they promised, one of the things that gave them victory was to really, as I said, double down and reinforce a much more harsh form of segregation. And they do that, beginning really in the 50s and accelerating in the 60s all the way into the 70s. Apartheid, which means apartness. Mm-hmm. So it had a lot in common with what we, when we think about it at all, associate with the Jim Crow era and segregation, but it also had a lot in common with Indian policy. And that's why it's sometimes hard to just sort of ram it into the American experience, because it also involved these enormous areas called reserves. Later, they were called Bantustans or homelands that were supposedly Africa. They're almost like Indian reservations. And that's where these people allegedly lived and had legal citizenship and right of, basically the right to stay there, and yet they're working in all these all-white areas. Essentially, the country, about 86% of it was named all-white. And this was either farmland or just about every city. Now, there were large black and colored and Asian, as they called Indian immigrants, populations there, but they were there as guests. And what many of us would argue was their own country, but that's not how the system was constructed. So you both have petty apartheid, as it was called, sort of small apartheid. This was separate amenities. There was a separate amenities act there, as, you know, like many of Jim Crow laws here, whether it's bathrooms, train cars, buses, water fountains. So what we think of as segregation, that's happening. But then in addition to that, they're literally bulldozing them out of areas like District 6 or Sophia Town outside of Johannesburg that was also destroyed. That was another multi-ethnic, vibrant, subculture-filled zone that they just destroy. And they are forced into these so-called homelands or reserves, Essentially, they come to a place like Johannesburg and Cape Town, spend their most productive years toiling for very little money, and then are dumped back on the reserve to die with no social service provision. I mean, this was a way to essentially externalize the costs of using African labor, and it made them essentially aliens in their own country. And this was a system that not only fragmented whites, blacks, and coloreds, and Asians, who all were considered different categories, even different African ethnic communities were split up and weren't supposed to cross with one another. So the Venda or the Pedi or the Tswana or the Xhosa, also, like, their ID cards didn't just say black, they said Xhosa or Zulu. So there was even an attempt to partialize based on sort of constructed African ethnicities. Even so, this is why, you know, when I took students there, they sort of expected to see, oh, this will be just like the American South, sort of. But it was a way more extreme system. It lasted way longer. I mean, this was not dismantled until the 1990s. So South Africa takes this very sharp turn away from civil rights, away from decolonization, and constructs, you know, this system that, you know, white people were very, very privileged. They didn't always recognize that privilege. I had many very awkward conversations with white South Africans who, well, I was against apartheid. Almost all of them said that. White South Africans have been pretty slow to recognize either A, what apartheid did in terms of wealth and assets. I mean, this was it created a grotesquely inegalitarian society in which whites and certain intermediary groups, you know, it built privilege in sort of a pyramidal hierarchy, had more than the vast majority of the population who essentially had nothing. They don't really acknowledge that. And the settlement that ended apartheid didn't really do much with property. I mean, essentially the deal when the ANC and the white-dominated government fought each other to a standstill in the late 80s, the deal that was worked out is political control would revert to the African majority, but you're not going to touch property. I think it's reasonable for us sitting here to judge them for that. They had to do something. I mean, ultimately, this was a solution that pleased no one, but I have very vivid memories from the 80s of South Africa just being this cauldron of violence. I mean, mm-hmm. It was apartheid's end was not particularly pleasant or pretty. That being said, it did not turn into a massive civil war in which hundreds of thousands died, which many people were expecting. In fact, if you told me as late as 92 that apartheid was going to end essentially peacefully through a negotiated settlement, I would have said you were crazy, but it did happen. But a lot of those legacies remain, you know, and this movie is both, I think, supposed to be a reminder to contemporary South Africans of the system that was built that gave them so much privilege and so much wealth and so many benefits. And I think it's also supposed to be a sort of a reminder to all South Africans, including black or so-called colored South Africans, that xenophobia didn't die in 1994.